TED Audio Collective.
You're growing a business, and you can't afford to slow down. If anything, you could probably use a few more hours in the day. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate, no coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Canva presents stories to keep you up at night. It was an ordinary work day until
the Singapore presentation is at
3 a.m.
The office was shocked.
But that's when we sleep.
Maya made it less scary with Canva.
I'll just record my presentation so Singapore can watch it anytime.
Record and present anytime with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
I was teaching swimming lessons, you know, like in my late teens or early 20s. And there was a baby possum in the pool. And I thought, yeah, I could get him out. But if I get him out, you know, is he going to turn on me? Is he not? And so I just think it's better to kill this possum.
The woman whose voice you're hearing has been diagnosed as a sociopath. Her name, where she lives, we won't learn those things today.
I just did what I thought was, you know, safest for me or like most expedient, right? So I try to drown it by like turning a hose on him, you know. I try for like, you know, 5-7 minutes or something and fail. You know, the animal keeps surviving. I'm not able to drown it. So then I just, you know, say, okay, I don't care. You know, I'll just cancel the lessons for today and then I'll just go to the beach or whatever instead. It's easy for me, honestly. It's easy not to let things affect me emotionally.
I'm Sarah Kay, and this is Sincerely X from TED. The show where we hear stories from anonymous people and give light to ideas we might never hear otherwise.
If I kind of had like a scale, you know, like 1 to 10, sociopath, like the most extreme person is a 10, you know, somebody who's not functional in society at all, I would say that I'm about an 8. I'm not so extreme. You know, I'm pretty functional in society. I've worked as a professional all of my adult life. I enjoy music. I have a really close relationship with my family. I love small children. I love to eat at Chick-fil-A. That's my favorite restaurant. These are more of the kind of obvious things that you'll see if you interact with me. You know, like maybe you'd understand that I'm pretty educated, you know, that I'm, you know, relatively intelligent. But as you kind of like deal with me, I think most people would understand too that there's something a little bit off.
When you hear the word sociopath, what is your first thought? Is it that sociopaths are ruthless killers, heartless manipulators, that they live on the outskirts of society? Those are pretty common instincts. In this episode, our guest invites us to think about sociopathy differently. We explore the stigma and stereotypes surrounding her condition and learn how our understanding of sociopathic people affects the way they're able to contribute to society. I wanted to kind of begin with the assumption that someone listening to our conversation perhaps knows absolutely nothing about sociopathy. So would you mind telling me how you would describe it to someone?
So the characteristics are probably the big ones are low empathy or a lack of empathy. And that's like effective empathy. That's like, I don't feel, you know, if somebody else is feeling sad, I don't also feel sad. And then another one, it's related is, you know, lack of guilt. Guilt requires you, number one, having a self concept, you know, like, you know, I am this type of person, and then you have violated that self-concept. So that's kind of the third thing is that all personality disorders have, and sociopathy is a personality disorder, all personality disorders have some sort of disorder with the personality, right? The person's sense of identity or their sense of self. For the sociopath, I think of it as like more like a persona, the same way you know, maybe a politician or a TV personality might have a persona that they present to the world, and they know that that's how they they're perceived, although they don't necessarily identify with that persona. But they, you know, the difference between them and me is, you know, when they go home, maybe they feel like they're a different person. And I just never feel like I'm any sort of person at all. I just have this like feeling that, you know, all the time, really, that I'm wearing masks.
And because she feels that she's wearing a mask all the time, she's functioning in the world by mirroring how people react or what they do in different situations, not because it's a choice she made for herself.
Normal people make choices based on their sense of self, primarily. You know, like, why do you be honest, or why do you choose to tell a lie? It's probably because you either have a sense that you are an honest person or sense that you're like an opportunistic person who likes to lie, you know, and get away with it.
I'm curious about the sense of self. How does the having a lack of sense of self or a disconnect between the way the world sees you and who you feel yourself to be, how does that play out in like a practical way in somebody's life?
I think everybody understands that to a certain extent and has experienced that to a certain extent. You know, everyone, you know, wears clothes that they don't want to wear, you know, that they're uncomfortable, but that's what's expected of them for whatever reason in that particular context, where everybody feels like they're making some concessions, you know, where they're not being their true self all the time. And then I guess just the difference is like a sociopath, you know, they don't have any sort of means of self-expression, really, because they don't have a sense of the self to express. But it's kind of worse because it's like, because you don't have a self to express, you never really push back ever on the world, too. You know, I think a normal person is like, enough is enough. You know, I'm wearing sweatpants today, you know, to work, right? Or whatever it is. So they're, you know, the lack of sincerity to it all, I think actually, you know, makes sociopaths tend to be like pretty skeptical of people, other people, of the world, of, you know, the whole social construct. Kind of think, you know, like everything's pretty meaningless. I think it seems kind of absurdist to them. So, I mean, I think they're further disconnected from the rest of people and the rest of the world because the whole thing kind of seems like meaningless. You know, life seems meaningless when that's kind of like all that you're doing.
Let's talk a little bit about your timeline. So is there a moment when you started to notice that something was different about you? And what was it you were noticing and what was going on for you at that time?
I think I understood, even when I was a small child, that I was different. You know, the thing I noticed first is how often people are irrational. And I was able to see, like, in my, like, little, like, 3, 4, 5 years old, probably, I was able to notice right away in my classmates that they were frequently irrational and that it was kind of easy to predict their irrationality and that you could kind of like, you know, manipulate them to be irrational if you wanted them to be, or, you know, to maybe talk them down if you didn't want them to be. I think that was the thing that I noticed first in terms of being different from other people is how subject to their emotions people are. And I think that that's still stayed the same. It's always been the same. In fact, when I was little, I was like watching one of these like, you know, TV shows where there's some kid or, you know, parents who lost a kid or something and everybody's crying. And I made some kind of like smart aleck remark about like they're ugly crying, right? They're ugly crying on TV. And I said something about like how bad they look or something. And my dad was like, "Have you no empathy?" And I was like, "I don't even know what the word empathy is, but I guess I don't."
That was the moment you learned about empathy and you were like, okay, this is a thing I don't have. That someone's telling me I'm supposed to. And did you then start to figure out how to perform empathy instead?
I mean, yeah, I guess I didn't really, I think, understand what empathy was. I was like 8 or 9, but I think I understood, okay, you know, if I say things this way in these type of circumstances, then I get a negative reaction. So I at least learned that there was like something else being expected of me. And then I have tried, or maybe, you know, in trying, pretended to be like more sympathetic, I think, to sad situations than I would otherwise be. Go to your, you know, best friend's mom's funeral or something and, you know, at least wear black. You know, I'm super good about, you know, like looking the part, you know, like, you know, to look like I'm taking it seriously, right? Because I mean, I do take it seriously. but I'm not going to have the emotional reaction, or I'm not going to have the empathy or the other things that you would expect from a normal person.
It's fascinating to me because it's like if I'm meeting someone who is from a different culture and or from a different religion, I would do the research ahead of time to know, you know, kind of standard things that would be appropriate and inappropriate so that when I show up at their house, I'm not doing anything that would offend them and I'm, you know, playing by the rules of a culture that I'm not necessarily a part of, but want to be respectful of. And it kind of sounds like that's what you're doing, is that you recognize that this is somebody else's culture of empathy, but you can be respectful of it even though it doesn't mean anything to you.
Exactly. Yeah. The people who go to a Jewish wedding and put on a yarmulke, they're not believers, right? But they do it out of respect. You don't believe in the underlying principles, but you're willing to do this because that's the thing that's expected of you. You know, I can put myself in somebody else's shoes and be like, oh, okay, yeah, you know, having a mom die would be, you know, a very terrible thing. You know, it would change almost every aspect of your life, it seems like, you know, for decades into the future, you know, and I could see how people would be very upset about it, right? I can feel, or not feel, I can understand all those things.
1 year in a summer internship, our guest had a lot of conversations with a colleague. And from those conversations, her colleague suggested that she may want to consider the possibility that she's a sociopath. Now, for our guest, this was the first time she thought the word sociopath might apply to her. Years after the internship, she started having trouble at work and problems in her relationships. She took a sabbatical to focus on herself, really to learn more about herself. And eventually, she sought out a diagnosis.
I think for me, I sought out the diagnosis more as a confirmation of things that I had already kind of known were true. You know, like I think that all sociopaths I have met are self-aware. They may not know the word sociopath applies to them. They may not understand what the word sociopath means, but they would recognize it, you know, when they see it, right? I think that's a very common characteristic. For me, I was interested because I was like, it was such a different kind of life trajectory that I was kind of contemplating taking that I thought, well, I want to be really sure that this is what's really going on. But I think, you know, that's probably like common for most sociopaths is that they know what they are, even if they don't know the label. Once they learn the label, most of the time they don't, you know, want to change right away. Most of the time their life is going probably fine enough. But eventually maybe they're going to hit a point where they're like, you know, I basically keep doing the same stuff over and over again. You know, I keep cycling through the same behaviors and through the same patterns. And maybe they want a little disruption for nothing else, maybe just for the variety, you know, for the novelty of it.
So what are your thoughts about empathy in general?
I have a lot of thoughts about empathy. You know, like, especially living without empathy, you're able to see a little bit more clearly what empathy does and what it doesn't do. It's like you rely on empathy instead of relying on, like, your ability to reason, for instance. You know, you could just have a set of ethics, right? You could just be a utilitarianist or you could be whatever it is and just say, I'm going to do the right thing because it's for the greatest good. But most people don't kind of go even through that thought process. They just do things when they feel that the thing is right and they don't do things when they feel the thing is wrong. Because rather than thinking kind of rationally about things, everybody's just learned to kind of go with their gut. And so when we go to kind of like discuss it with somebody who has a different idea about something that's right or wrong, also coming from their place of empathy, there's just no common ground there because people haven't gone through the trouble of identifying what is the rational basis for the things that they choose to do and the things that they think are good. I mean, I think that people think that sociopaths are irrational, probably, when actually it's the opposite. They're hyper-rational. You know, like they don't have the emotions kind of clouding, I don't want to say clouding their judgment, but a little bit. Even though the sociopath is grandiose, I would say they don't have the same sorts of, let's say, ego hurt that normal people do that can really trigger a person. You know, like kind of this gut punch, you know, sucker punch, like where it hits you where like all of your insecurities are, right? Because the sociopath doesn't have that sense of identity. They don't have those insecurities. So that never happens, right? That's like that's high emotional reactivity, and sociopaths have very low emotional reactivity. I have to think, you know, mob mentality is empathy related because sociopaths are immune to it. It's as if, you know, like the electrical current's going through and we're just not a conductor. It doesn't like continue. It has no effect on us. sociopaths tend to be very open. You know, I think everybody could benefit from being a little bit more open to thinking, you know, when something happens, not just go with your initial emotional reaction, but kind of think through it a little bit more.
I'm curious because my limited understanding of sociopaths, of course, but my understanding is that sociopaths often have a pretty inflated sense of self or a pretty good ego. And that does not lend itself naturally, I don't think, towards like an openness to self-improvement and or a willingness to try therapy and or a willingness to believe that a therapist is going to be able to offer them something that they can't figure out on their own.
This is also pretty common, I found, is that sociopaths have had some interaction with like the psychological community. You know, either they've had a therapist, you know, one or two therapists even. I think the attitude in the psychological community is that sociopaths are untreatable. So I think sociopaths are kind of aware of that. It's not just that they don't want to get better. It's that there is no promise or hope of getting better, you know, even if they kind of wanted to.
Do you think that both the, you know, social public reaction to sociopathy and also the reaction within the psychological community is different from what it is to other personality disorders? Like, how have you experienced that?
I don't think that sociopaths are the only people with stigma. But I do think, yeah, sociopaths do have the worst maybe of the stigma. I think partly because of, you know, the way that the diagnostic criterion has evolved has really focused on the criminal population. You know, like, it's not true that most sociopaths are criminal. And in fact, it's the opposite. The vast majority of sociopaths are not criminal. They're out there being successful. They're doing various things, but they're not allowed to really kind of disclose to anybody who they are.
What do you think that sociopaths can teach non-sociopaths?
I think there are a couple things, you know, like sociopaths, the fact that they don't care what other people think, you know, I think that's really freeing. I wish that everybody could be more like that. You know, I don't think that fear of what other people think should be the reason why we choose to do the things that we choose to do. You know, sociopaths rarely shy away from confrontation. You know, it's not something that like bothers them.
And it doesn't hurt you because you don't register pain based on people disliking you?
Yes, that's probably a really good way to put it. And I don't know why that is, but like a lot of people have said, that's like the sociopath's superpower is to not care what other people think of them. And I don't care if people like me or don't like me, basically.
Why was it important to you to talk with us today?
I think it's important to me primarily because, you know, this is like this is a true misunderstanding that people have, and it's making everything worse. You know, sociopaths have it worse because of this misunderstanding, because of the stigma, but so does society have it worse because we're not doing the things like early intervention or getting people treatment to where like they wouldn't be causing problems. Or the lack of understanding leads to, you know, the sociopaths having to wear a mask. And then normal people don't like that because it seems like they're getting defrauded. You know, it seems like they're getting tricked all the time. But it's like very this catch-22 situation where as long as there's like this kind of base misunderstanding about what it means to be a sociopath, nothing's going to get better, right? It's going to keep kind of perpetuating itself. We're going to have like very limited sorts of solutions that are available to us. So I see that as an issue, you know, for myself, for the larger community. And I think especially I have like now tons, like double digits nephews and nieces. And each one of them are also different. Some of them are so emotional and so empathetic. And some of them are more like me, right? You know, sometimes, especially the ones that are more like me, they can rub people the wrong way. You know, even like my own family members. And I always try to tell them, hey, we need to show them what is so great about love, so they'll care about it and care about us. Like, if we don't show them what's so great about this thing, then obviously they're not going to care. They're not going to care about us. They're not going to care about anything. Like, it's up to us to kind of do this. And that's the sort of, like, early intervention type stuff that I want to be, like, broader, to be more available to them so they don't have to kind of go through the same things that I did.
In a moment, we'll speak with an expert on empathy, about its benefits, its limits, and whether we should try to feel it for people like our guest. even when they can't feel it for us. I'm Sarah Kay, and this is Sincerely X. We've been speaking with a woman who's been diagnosed as a sociopath, who believes that non-sociopaths have a lot to learn from sociopaths. She gave me permission to share our conversation with Jamil Zaki, the director of the Social Neuroscience Lab at Stanford University. For the past 15 years, Jamil has studied empathy, in particular, why some people are more empathic than others, and how we can help people empathize in more effective ways. He even wrote a book on it, The War for Kindness, Building Empathy in a Fractured World. Empathy is often seen as a good thing. I wanted to hear Jamil's take on empathy. Is empathy objectively good? Or is there research that suggests empathy is more or less useful in different situations?
As a scientist, I'm not pro-empathy or against empathy, right? Empathy is just a thing. It's just part of our minds, as part of our lives. In many cases, it has tangible and palpable benefits, right? It helps people form the most important connections in their lives and keep those connections strong. It helps people work together. It helps us help each other, right? Empathic individuals more likely to donate to charity or volunteer than those who have less empathy. And it decreases our stereotypes. When we empathize with someone from another group, we oftentimes feel more openness towards the rest of that group. So it's a good thing in those ways, but there are real risks as well. I mean, burnout is so prevalent among people who work in the face of others suffering all the time. And likewise, when we empathize super strongly with our own group, that can actually make us feel more hostile or threatened by or even violent towards threats to that group, whether they're real or imagined. And that's sometimes what, you know, sort of extremism amounts to, not a sociopathic lack of care for outsiders, but rather an almost unhinged level of care for insiders, for the people in our tribe, and a willingness to do anything on their behalf.
How does empathy and emotion relate or interact with rationality and decision making? I think a lot of people are of the opinion that those are antithetical.
I think one of the biggest, creakiest stereotypes about human psychology is this sort of split between reason and passion. That idea within psychology has collapsed. In particular, we now know that emotion and reason work with, not against each other. And that goes both ways. So gut instincts, or sort of our emotional intuitions, often help us make better decisions more efficiently and in ways that help us in the long run. And also, our rationality can help us choose our emotions, right? We exert lots of control over what we feel, and as a result, can tune what we feel in ways that we deem healthy or useful in the moment.
So the idea that we can learn to be more empathetic, how?
I mean, there are lots of experiences that cause people to be more empathic. Some of them happen by accident, right? So for instance, ironically, experiencing trauma, right? Sort of experiencing a lot of hardship in one's life. It turns out that in many cases, individuals who suffer trauma actually grow through that. Now, you know, I don't think that people would want to experience trauma on purpose simply to make themselves kinder, but there are also ways that we can practice empathy. One dramatic study that came out of Germany a couple of years ago used a meditation technique known as loving kindness. So people practiced this sort of meditation where they first try to focus their goodwill and compassion first on themselves, then on someone they care about, then on a stranger, then on a difficult person who they might not automatically like. And scientists scanned their brains before and after they practiced this meditation. And they found that the parts of their brain associated with empathy grew in volume as a result of this practice, suggesting that wow. if you work at it, you can not just change yourself psychologically, you can actually change yourself physically.
So let's turn to our guest for a second. Speaking, I guess, just generally at first, what was your reaction to this conversation that you got to hear?
You know, I think that she made a point that really resonated with me, which is that people with sociopathy and psychopathy and antisocial personality disorder, they're the last ones to get empathy, not only the last ones to feel it. We, as a society, I think, somehow feel okay stigmatizing them and writing them off. They're viewed as hopeless, and that's unfair and unjust, and it likely perpetuates their difficulties adjusting to society. So I thought that her perspective and clarity really helped break that barrier.
You know, something that I thought was really amazing was that she talked about sociopathy in a way that felt like it was advantageous, and that non-sociopaths, because they are bogged down by empathy and emotion and fear, have a disadvantage to sociopaths who don't have that baggage. And I'm curious what your response is to that idea.
That was so fascinating to hear her talking about that, because there's actually all sorts of evolutionary theories about this, right? There's the idea that in a society or group where most people are empathic, somebody who, in a cavalier manner, uses that entire system only for their own benefit without any regard for other people's well-being will win, right? They can cheat their way to the top by depending on the empathy and cordiality of strangers. But there's a big caveat to that perspective from evolutionary theory, which is that that only works if the number of people who are cheaters or sociopaths is far outnumbered by the number of people who are not, right? So one cheater in a world full of empathizers will do great, you know, from an outcome-oriented standard. But an entire group that's made up of only cheaters will collapse, right? So she's right in at one level, but that's not necessarily a stable strategy for a whole group of people to adopt.
You know, we're talking about the connection between emotions and decision-making and how they're not in separate places and how they are connected to each other. Our guest kind of talked about how a problem that she sees is that people engage in conflict or disagreements often led by their emotions, and that there isn't enough of a rational basis for our beliefs, and sociopaths are outcome-driven beings. And perhaps those of us who are not sociopaths would be better off if we engaged with our ideas and each other's in a more rational and less emotional way. Do you think that we should be trying to think more rationally about things like beliefs and values?
Yeah, I really feel that the distinction between rationality and emotion is misleading. I suppose I prefer the term awareness. I think it's good for us to be aware of where the decisions we're making are coming from, what's driving them, and whether we're happy with the way that our decisions are coming about. But I think that when people say they're being rational, they often just become less curious about why they're making the decisions they're making, or just basically decide that they must have made the right choice because they were rational. I think there's evidence that rationality is in no way a bulletproof vest against bias or even violence.
To me, I keep picturing like people thinking that this is a seesaw and on one side is emotion and the other is rationality. And if you are sitting heavy on the rationality, it means you don't have anything on the emotions. And if you're sitting heavy on the emotions, it means your rationality is up in the air, but that just isn't actually an accurate understanding of it at all. And so I love the understanding that you've given me, which is that just because someone doesn't have access to their emotions in the way that we do, that doesn't mean that their rationality is higher.
I love that metaphor. That's exactly right. That's the stereotype that we have, and it's the one that we would be well served to let go.
So I want to return to the idea that empathy is a practice that can be learned and can be developed. Is that still true for people like our guest who have a diagnosed personality disorder? Like, what about people who have sociopathy in particular? Can they still develop their empathy?
Yeah, there's some evidence that people with psychopathy and sociopathy can work at empathy. It's hard work for them, and it's harder work for them than it is for people without those conditions. But it's not impossible. My friend Christian Kiezers, he's a neuroscientist in the Netherlands, and he actually found that, in most people's brains, there's this mirroring process where the parts of your brain that would come online when you experience pain also come online when you see someone else experience pain, right? In essence, at a physiological level, it appears as though you feel their pain. Christian found that that was not true of people with psychopathy. But if he asked them to think really hard about what that person was feeling and try to imagine being in their shoes, their brains sort of came online in the way that the brains of non-psychopaths did, right? So they almost, in essence, were able to manually turn up an empathic process that for the rest of us is more automatic.
I only have one more question for you, which is, you know, our guest talks a lot about making sure she goes through the motions of showing that she cares about people in her life, even if she doesn't actually empathize with what they're feeling. So the example she gives is if she goes to a funeral, she knows to wear black and to be somber. And she made the comparison to like going to a Jewish wedding and wearing a yarmulke, even though you're not a believer. Do you think it's possible to become more empathetic by performing these kinds of rituals of care?
Wow. That's an amazing question that I'm afraid I don't have a great answer to. I mean, I loved the comparison to sort of intercultural exchange, right? To thinking that really, you know, people who experience the world through different lenses, whether those lenses have to do with where they grew up, the sort of cultures that they're part of, or their psychological makeup, right, that they can interact in fruitful ways without seeing the world identically, right? I mean, one place that that's really been successful is the neurodiversity movement, right? People with autism and Asperger's see the world differently than people who are, in quotes, neurotypical, who don't have those conditions. And you know, part of the neurodiversity movement is understanding how people who are neurotypical and those who are not can interact productively together. And I felt as though the guest was sort of gesturing in that direction for sociopathy as well, right? And saying that, hey, you know, we don't have to be exactly alike to get along. We just have to respect each other's norms and cultures and experiences. And I thought it was actually quite moving that she would know to practice empathic behaviors, even if she wasn't feeling them. The question as to whether you can sort of fake it until you become it is an open one. But to me, I already saw that as a victory. I would find it so respectful and so powerful that she was just trying, even if it was just a performance. If someone doesn't feel, can you feel for them? I think that's a question that we need to answer positively. We need to learn to understand that just because someone doesn't share our experience doesn't mean that they're not worthwhile, that they can't be part of our culture. And when we invite people with psychopathy and sociopathy to take part in our culture, then yes, I think that they'll be more able to find ways to do so. And we don't have to try to sort of fit them into the exact mold of feeling other people's emotions and caring about what other people feel, but we can work together to find ways for them to be more integrated.
So what is it that you want listeners to take away from your experience and also this conversation?
You know, I don't ever mean to whitewash sociopaths. I don't mean to say that they're better or worse than anybody else. It's just that they're different. And the kind of misconceptions that we have about them, though, are, I think, the main source of the problems. You know, everybody's different, but we have learned to kind of accept and accommodate so many differences. And I guess I'm just trying to say, can we learn to accept and accommodate just one more different type of mind?
Sincerely X is produced by Magnificent Noise for TED. Our production staff includes Kim Naderfane-Petersa, Noor Wazwaz, Destry Sibley, Eva Walchover, and Chloe Shasha, with the help of Angela Chang, Janet Lee, Michelle Quint, Jesse Baker, and Colin Helms. Our fact-checker is Lorena Aviles Trujillo. This episode was mixed and sound designed by Kristen Muller. Our executive producer is Eric Newsom. If you or someone you know has a story that you think should be shared anonymously with others, please let us know at ted.com/sincerelyx. I'm Sarah Kay, and this is Sincerely X.